Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of software engineering teams. I'm your host, Aaron Syme. In today's episode, we're going to cover a lot of different topics about the human side of managing software engineers. My guest, Ben Pariseau, shares with us insights around diversity and inclusion in tech and how to track and improve the overall satisfaction of your developers, as well as the use of AI in software development. All of that can lead to higher retention rates and higher performing teams. So these are not only topics important to the culture of your organization, but also the overall performance of your company. So let's get to our conversation with Ben and learn how to lead happier software development teams.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Ben Pariseau is the software engineering manager at Planet Argon, a Ruby on Rails agency that helps companies and organizations modernize and future-proof their Rails apps. As an engineering manager, Ben constantly reviews and improves team processes and best practices and works with engineers to broaden and improve their skills and advance in their careers. Ben is also proudly queer and a strong advocate for LGBTQ plus representation in tech. We'll talk about diversity and inclusion today, as well as improving developer satisfaction. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Ben.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
So happy to have you join us. Really appreciate it. And I've noticed what a nice job you do on LinkedIn of highlighting jobs available in software engineering. So I want to start a little bit with that. And you talk a lot about helping people move into tech jobs. What are you seeing in the software development job market right now?
Oh, that's a great question. There are fewer jobs, I would say, generally. I don't think that's a big shock to anybody. There's specifically a lot of fewer junior entry-level roles. When I first started doing this, I was more involved in a Portland-based meetup that was targeting junior developers, and I put a lot of time into looking for junior roles for those devs, because I know that when you're first starting out, it can be a little bit difficult to know where to look to find open roles. So I just want to kind of be a resource to junior devs getting into the field. That's a little bit harder now. There's fewer roles for junior early career devs, a lot more senior roles, staff roles. There's a lot of, not surprisingly, machine learning, data science roles with the rise of AI this past year. There's a lot of integration roles I've noticed, probably because everyone wants their existing app to integrate with some sort of GPT or AI model. Even if they're not like specifically integration engineering roles, there's a lot of integration requirements in the roles that I've been seeing. So working with SDKs, integrating with other APIs, writing APIs, that sort of thing. Yeah, there's been a move towards familiarity with app infrastructures and deployment tools, even for like explicitly front-end positions, which is kind of new, I've been noticing. You know, before it was like, oh, do you know HTML, JavaScript, and CSS? Okay, you're a front engineer. And now it's, oh, can you set up a CI/CD pipeline? Great. That's part of your role as well. AWS services, containers, serverless tools, things like that are all sort of being thrown into the mix for most all kinds of roles that I've been looking at.
Ben, I really appreciate you sharing a lot of information there about your background. And certainly, you know, I think some of the, you talked about your journey into being a developer. I think you said you were an English major originally, on the journalism side. I mean, some of the best developers I've worked with, my first mentor as a software engineer myself was an English major. One of the best front-end developers I've ever hired and worked with, she was originally a hotel management degree as well. So, you know, people can obviously come from all sorts of educational backgrounds and become really excellent members of software development teams in a variety of roles as well. Let's talk a little bit, too, about your experiences coming from a different background as well and sort of your experiences in tech with being queer in tech.
Yeah. So luckily, I just want to say I've never been on a team where I've experienced any sort of direct or explicit discrimination for being gay. That's very great. I think that's partially because of the teams that I've been on and the companies that I've worked with have had really great inclusive cultures. Partially, I think, is that that's just because tech is just a little bit more self-aware in that regards, in some ways. I will say that, especially early on in my career, that most all of the teams that I were on were almost exclusively cis, white, straight men. Now I am, you know, a cis white man myself, so I have some of that privilege and I could integrate on those teams pretty well. But, you know, there's something to be said for even having a little bit of difference from, you know, from everyone else on your team. There's something inherently othering about being the only one of any kind of something. So, you know, my privilege allowed me to integrate and be pretty okay on those teams and not feel any real distinct difference. But, you know, there's something to be said about being the only queer member of a team. And I can't even imagine what it's like to be, you know, a non-white member of the team or non-female presenting, trans, you know, anything like that would be much, I think, I imagine a much harder integration.
Sure.
Or,
yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I mean, I'm glad that you've had a largely positive experience. And I think in general, I hope that's the case in the tech industry as well. You know, but obviously culture varies company to company and situations vary company to company. And you know, for someone like me, I personally check all of the boxes of like the most privileged categories. So it's hard for me also to, you know, have that perspective. So I appreciate, you know, you sharing a perspective and kind of, you know, I think it's important for all of us as engineering leaders, regardless of our own backgrounds, to be aware of the possibility of people feeling othered, you know, in any situation. And so I think for somebody like me, who, you know, I'm not part of the LGBTQ plus community myself, but I have multiple family members and friends who are, and so it's important to me. What is the best way you would recommend someone like myself in a leadership role to be a good ally to others?
There's a million ways. I think being self-aware in the way that you've just described yourself is probably the biggest part. Being aware of your privilege and being aware of what it means to be, you know, a cis white male in this industry and just sort of the doors that that opens for you, myself included. I would say that there's, you know, structural systemic things that companies can do to be more inclusive and provide safer spaces for people coming onto their teams. And there's also individual stuff that team members will need to learn on their own, possibly like at the behest of the company through trainings and stuff. The thing that I've seen the most that's been, even on those teams that I felt really comfortable and I thought were pretty inclusive, there's an issue around hiring and diversifying your team that is even rampant in those types of teams, which is like, oh, it's the pipeline. You know, you hear that a lot. There's a pipeline problem. I would love to hire a woman, love to hire a non-white cis male developer. There's just no candidates for that. Of course, the people that are generally saying that are the people that are cis, straight, white, male. And they're generally, even if they don't realize it, using like the same pipelines that they went through. So it's about the same type of people. They're, you know, and so they're seeing the same types of people coming in because it's the same pipeline that they went through. And they're not putting a ton of effort into diversifying their sourcing of candidates. That's not going to get you very good results in terms of the applicants that you're looking for. You have to engage with different groups of underrepresented people, and you have to engage with them not only when you need them. It's not like a spigot that you can turn on and off when you want a queer candidate or a Black candidate or a Latina candidate. You have to be in those communities and building relationships just for the sake of doing that and supporting them. You know, I like meetups are a great way to do that. Going to meetups for underrepresented groups, talking to people, not taking up too much space, but supporting them, possibly if you can financially support these organizations, that's a great way to do it. Becoming paid members of things. For hiring, you can there's often orgs that, you pay to get your jobs listed on their boards and stuff. We do that at Planet Argonne. And that's a great way to get a more diverse candidate set. Yeah, I mean, there's also not just hiring concerns. Obviously, when you have a team that is a little more diverse, well, really just any team, I would say, you need to make sure that you're creating a place of psychological safety for everyone. And that especially goes, this is especially true for people that might have experienced poor team cultures in the past. They're going to be, understandably a little more defensive and not 100% comfortable joining your team of all white dudes.
Right.
So, there's things that you should be doing to try and make everyone feel heard and make them feel like they are not only safe to exist on your team, but safe to voice their opinion or disagree with someone.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned the term psychological safety. I'd love to talk about that a little bit more. And, I know the term in particular from my training in the context of agile retrospectives and talking about making sure that, when a team wants to bring issues to the table, that they have the psychological safety in that team, they have the comfort level to be able to raise difficult things going on in the team. But those are, traditionally more around process too. Is there a way that you would kind of define that term, or any tips that you would share for engineering leaders about how to encourage that psychological safety within their teams, in particular in the context of inclusion?
I'm not a DEI expert, but I will say, just having some lived experience and having some work experience specifically here at Planet Argonne, I think that the most important thing to do is educate yourself. Oftentimes you have really well-meaning managers, really well-meaning team members that just don't know where there might be areas that are, or things that are making people feel unsafe or unheard. So I would, do the research, read DEI experts in the field around, queer representation, representation of women and non-white people. I would say that talking to your team members is also just a really easy way to do it. And not even with leading questions like, hey, how can I make you feel more safe here? That kind of could be a weird conversation if the person doesn't necessarily feel that they aren't safe. But framing it in the terms of, do you feel like you're being heard? Do I call on you enough in meetings? How is your communication on, let's say PR reviews? Does your feedback get accepted or rejected? And do you notice any trends in communication with your colleagues or your boss? So those are some things you can do. I think structurally, you can also just have mandatory, DEI training. That's pretty simple. There's lots of resources out there that offer classes, online classes, stuff. It's all pretty corny in terms of the production value, not the content. Sure. But, I fight a little cynical man inside of me every time I log into those things. But by the end, I'm like, yeah, that's right. That's great. So if you can get over the cheese factor of those videos, I would say that, they do teach people things that they might not learn. And I would say, it's important to recognize that acceptance and making people comfortable is a very, what's the word I'm looking for? Intersectional endeavor. So, like I said, I am a gay man, but I'm also a man. I'm also white. I have lots of blind spots when it comes to working with women and people of color. And I need to train myself on those issues and make sure that I'm not saying or doing anything that makes people feel uncomfortable and just playing it off because, oh, I'm gay, so I can say that.
And I appreciate your pipeline comments a lot too. And I think I think you have some organizations, you know, you can mention, we can definitely also put up on the show notes for this episode around different groups that, you know, like you talked about reaching out to in terms of pipeline. Anyone you want to give a shout out to? I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, WebRTC Ventures. At WebRTC Ventures, our teams are experts in building live video into your web or mobile applications. We've literally built hundreds of them. We have over a decade of experience using both open source and commercial media servers in a wide range of industries, including telehealth, ed tech, broadcasting, and more. We also publish a lot of helpful tips and industry interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. So be sure to check out webrtc.ventures, and we can help you build, scale, and deploy your video solution.
I have been involved more actively in the past, though, with Out in Tech. That's a great queer tech organization. They've got, you know, chapters all over the country. Women in Tech, the same. Been to a number of their conferences. Blacks in Technology, People of Color in Tech. Techeria is a good... Yeah, there's just great. I mean, like, just... those are all really great ones. People should go to them to support those orgs. There's also just, like, a ton that you can just find, and probably local chapters as well in your area that are probably more, maybe there's like an easier in to those orgs because you can go meet them in person, find out if there's any like ways that you can help their org besides just, you know, like a monthly contribution or something.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely share those on the scalingtechpod.com for this episode, and really appreciate you sharing your perspective on that, Ben. Thank you. Let's talk about, let's shift over more to developer satisfaction in general now, and talk about a little bit about what are some of the best ways to track and improve developer satisfaction. How do you handle that?
So I've been working on improving our DevEx at Planet Argon for, gosh, ever since I started, really, and have really like had a structured plan in place since like 2021. So good going on 3 years now. The first thing I think that you will need to do is learn about what it means when people talk about developer experience or developer satisfaction. People, I think, correlate DevEx and productivity or, you know, just general employee satisfaction. And I guess they are correlated, but they're not the same thing. So when we're talking about developer satisfaction or developer experience, we're talking about things that the developer or your engineering team as a whole is experiencing every day in their day-to-day work that is causing them to like or not like what they're doing. So these are, you know, workflows, deployment workflows, project application setup, PR review processes, how much focus time they have. So there's lots of different areas that can influence developer experience and lead to more or less satisfaction amongst your team. Once you kind of have a good idea of what you want to be measuring or what you want to be focusing on, you need to find a tool that will like easily complement your existing devs workflows in order to track how those sentiments are. So we use a tool I play in Argon called DX. It's basically a quarterly snapshot survey that goes out. It allows us to track, you know, sentiment scores over 12 different key developer satisfaction areas. And we keep them consistent over time so that we're getting a very clear long-term picture of like how people's feelings are changing on certain issues. Some ways that you can, you know, ours is Slack integrated, but they have to go to the website to do the survey. It's not that big of a lift, but you know, if you're a super small team or you don't want to integrate a new tool like a Google Form, can be good. I would suggest not doing like one-on-ones with people in this way, just because I found like, even though our team, like their name is on the results, I feel like having just a blank canvas, so to speak, to answer your questions and not have it be like your manager or some HR person asking you these questions, you get a little more thoughtful and probably honest responses. keep a consistent schedule. That's super important. People know every quarter that they are going to have to fill out this survey, and they've been doing it for almost 3 years now, so they know that it's coming. And then I would suggest showing the relevancy of the surveys that you're doing. So we take the results, we talk about them in our the next engineering team meeting that we have. And we use the feedback from those surveys to sort of determine what either the team or myself as the engineering manager is going to be working on for the next quarter. So that really reinforces participation, because it shows the team that, oh, even if, you know, you're giving something a consistently low score, if it's not being worked on, it's because we have talked about it and we haven't prioritized it. So they're coming back and they're, you know, filling it out quarter after quarter, because they see that it actually impacts their work.
I really appreciate the point about consistency, and I think that's super important. And I think, you know, for me personally, probably the area of biggest failing in doing this types of things is being consistent about it. It's so easy as a leader to get distracted by, you know, the tyranny of the urgent, the fire that needs to be put out now. I think another really interesting challenge for us that I'd love your perspective on is that, you know, your company Planet Argonne is a consultancy, much like my company is as well. And so it means that, you know, probably if you're like us, most of your employees are probably working with clients rather than on, say, you know, internal projects or products where you control everything about that. And that's an extra challenge, right? Because for our people on our team, you know, we can do what we can to control our company's culture and psychological safety and developer experience. But a lot of their day-to-day experience really is driven by what their client's experience is, especially if they're embedded in that client team. And yeah. So I imagine you face some similar challenges. Is there anything kind of extra that you're able to do around that, or you have to work around?
Yes and no. So I would say that from a sort of a company-wide standpoint, the best thing that we can do is try to keep all of the works more in-house, if that makes sense. You talked about embedding devs. We do that on occasion. We currently have an engineer embedded with a team remotely now. But most of the work that we do for our clients, they're hiring us as their, you know, their development team. And so we're controlling the work. Our PM is managing the project. Our AM is interacting with the client most often. And so there's a number of sort of buffers, I suppose, between client's feedback and reaction and the dev's work. Obviously, there's opportunities for direct conversation. They go back and forth in Jira comments and on Slack channels. But if there's something that is more like client dissatisfaction, that's going to be handled by an AM or, you know, at the very least, a PM. We set that expectation pretty early on in the relationship with the client by spelling out, like, here's the type of questions that you should bring to our developers and the forums in which you could bring those. And here's how you talk about everything else. So in terms of like the experience that our devs have working with clients, I think we do a pretty good job of keeping them more or less shielded from any sort of major client blowback. Luckily, we don't have a ton of those because I think they're really great. But now embedded devs, that's a whole nother story, right? Because that's what they're paying for, is someone to come in on their team and not take up any of the PMing or the team culture and just working with them. I think that requires a lot more vetting in terms of the client, like who are we going to accept as a team that we can place our devs. At the end of the day, they're still Planet Argonne employees. And so if they're unhappy on a team that we embedded them on, they're not going to blame that team. They're going to blame Planet Argonne. And they're going to say like, oh yeah, my boss sent me to this team and it was brutal and I did not have a good experience. Right. And so you have to be very sure that the development workflow, the sort of communication style, the team culture are all as similar to your existing team's communication style and culture as you can get.
Yeah, I completely agree with that for sure. I think having those the style and the culture as similar as possible has been a key for us. When I look back on clients that we've worked with where we've done a full embedded team staff augmentation type of model, the ones where it's most successful are absolutely the ones who, adhere to the way that we work. And so we've tried to be more diligent about, I think, as you said, vetting your clients for that. And, it in that sort of a relationship, especially when you do want to be protective of the team that you've hired, that you value, within your own company, trying to make sure that you're putting them in an environment that is as compatible as possible with the sort of company that they were hired into, right?
Yeah.
And that can be a real challenge sometimes, especially when sometimes you're facing other constraints too, and trying to, make a sale, work with a client that need, revenue that needs to be generated, but being really careful about where you put team members, especially in those sorts of embedded situations, is hard. One thing we did recently that I was thinking about, wanted to share. One of my colleagues, she leads a regular, basically a quarterly retrospective with our embedded clients, with our team members who are embedded with clients in more of that staff augmentation model. And in many ways, kind of, it's a retrospective that's a little bit of how is our relationship within our team going, and is there anything that we as leaders can do who are not directly involved in the day-to-day activities of the work, as well as how is your work going with the client, not really focusing on individual pieces of work so much, like as a retrospective should, but focusing on the process and what can we do to improve the way that we're working as a team and bring more to the team too, bring our expertise to them in other ways. An exercise she did in one of the recent ones that I really liked, if you've seen the Agile retrospective exercise of the pirate ship before, where we used a online whiteboard and there's a drawing of a pirate ship approaching a tropical island there. And you talk about, it's just a fun spin on, more traditional things like start, stop, go, what should we do? But, liven it up with a little different exercise of talking about tailwinds, headwinds, dangers, like rocks underneath that the ship could crash into as it approaches the island. What's the treasure we're hoping to find on the island, the positive goals we're trying to reach. But I, especially liked that kind of tailwind and headwind part of it, where you're talking about, a tailwind of what is, what's pushing us to that island faster. Like, what are the things that are going really well that we can do a better job of, or that we can maybe double down on because they lift our team up, they push us further, versus those headwinds of things that, we need to try and find a way to reduce the friction that's holding us back.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. I have to check out that. I haven't heard of the pirate. The pirate ship exercise. I'm gonna have to look into that. We've done so for our embedded devs, we stick with our bi-weekly one-on-one. So I'm meeting with him every other week, even though he's embedded in another team, and that gives him a chance to not only like fill me in on the work, but also talk about any issues that he's facing. Our PR is getting reviewed on time, or people being nice and courteous. Which they are, which is great this time. And the other opportunity that it gives us is for him to give us any feedback on processes or workflows that he's noticed on their team that he thinks that we might adopt. So we view, embedded devs relationships as not only us providing a service for another team or offering some help to another team, but then also the possibility of learning from that team to improve how we run our team.
Yeah, absolutely. Those best relationships are always bi-directional, right? Yeah. We're bringing things to our clients that they haven't seen before, and that's part of the value of working with us. And likewise, we learn something from each one of them as well. So now let's talk a little bit about AI and software development, you know, there's a lot of different ways that it's discussed, both maybe sometimes too hype driven and other times too fear driven as well. I usually fall somewhere in between those of, you know, what does it actually mean? But I think it's, given that it is a topic that can either carry a lot of hope or a lot of fear with it, I would imagine has an impact on developer experience. Yeah, how are you all using AI now in your software development, and you know, what impact do you think that has on developer experience?
Okay, so we have AI guidelines.
Just drop a small question on
just
you.
A tiny little question about a very niche topic that nobody's really paying attention to. No, it's great. I love this topic. I've talked with my team about it at great length. We have some like general guidelines outlined for using AI tools at Planet Argon. We do not have any AI tools that we have implemented sort of company-wide that we've chosen as like, oh, this is a tool that everyone on the team is going to and needs to use. We understand that tools, they're mostly productivity tools at this point, right? So people use productivity tools in different ways. Some people find them to be invasive or, you know, getting interrupting their workflow. Other people absolutely love them and for different reasons. So, you know, some of our engineers use Copilot. We have different use cases for that. Most everyone doesn't use like the auto complete aspect of Copilot, the code writing aspect of it when they're writing code. They will use it more for like test writing or something that's a little more templated and that they can just be like, oh yeah, you're writing a test here. Let me fill this out for you. So you don't have to just continuously write this boilerplate code over and over.
Right.
We've used some AI issue tracking and summary tools that have been helpful. So, you know, tools that integrate with our Jira boards and allow the project manager or myself to get a very high level overview of the work that's being done without having to either like filter, like create our own custom Jira filters or go to every board and pull up reports in that way. Of course, we use ChatGPT a lot, content creation mostly, although we also do, I know people use it for debugging issues. So, okay. We have a lot of different applications, a lot of different clients running different versions of different things on different applications. And so our devs' environments on their computers can get very messy because we have one app that requires this version of Ruby and this one requires a different one and then that one has a different version of Node. And so oftentimes, especially with new devs or interns, they'll come on and they'll be like trying to install or set up a specific application on their machine and run into some, errors, compatibility errors, that sort of thing. So we use like ChatGPT and the Copilot like chat box for that a lot because those are less like, oh, this is what this, here's exactly how to fix this, and more of here's what this error is trying to tell you and here's likely like the culprits of it. So, you know, if there's an error message that's not very clearly written or we have a dev that's not familiar with it enough, then we'll use tools for that.
Yeah, I think the way I'm thinking about it at the moment is a little analogous to like continuous integration and continuous deployment type of pipelines, especially when those were newer, in the sense that as a manager, you want to find the sweet spot between mandating the use of it and some base level things that you have to do. You know, your code has to have this level of testing before you commit it and push it, that sort of thing. Without over mandating exactly how you use it or sort of taking away all the creativity of the developers. Right.
Yeah.
And so then that hopefully, you know, just like someone who maybe is new to continuous integration at first, maybe they find some of it, you know, burdensome if they were a solo developer, you know, for a long time and maybe didn't have to do that sort of rigor for themselves. Now they're in a team and they're adjusting to that. You know, it's similar that we want to encourage and maybe in some cases mandate the use of the tool up to a certain point so that you build that habit of, oh, this can really help me with building better test test code and more repetitive type of code, like you said.
Right.
But doesn't, you know, I'm not expected to have the first version of every function I run write generated by Copilot or ChatGPT or something. You know, I still have creative freedom in how I implement these, but I learn how to take away some of the more painful or redundant parts along the way.
Yeah, so. I kind of similarly view it as like a spell check versus like autocomplete in like a Google Doc or something. So, you know, you're writing, like it used to be spell check was the only thing there, and you didn't mandate spell check necessarily for your team if they were writing something like. This is me going back to my writing background, but you would also expect that they were turning in, you know, an article that did not have any spelling errors in it. So there's the assumption that they're using a tool, although if they can completely write everything and not have any spelling errors themselves, it's great. They don't need it. But, you know, now there's like autocomplete in these in content creation doc tools and stuff. And it's like, okay, this is kind of helpful, but also it's like you're trying to write this for me. And I feel that that's a little, that blocks you sometimes, right? You're like, no, I'm trying to write a sentence and you're getting in my way. So I feel like the mandating it would be similar to like, oh, you have to let, you have to let Google Docs write like whatever they're going to suggest. That's what you just have to hit enter. And that's what they're going to, and that's what you're, doc is going to say. And it's like, you don't want that. That's very limiting for people. And same with the code tools, you know, like using it for debugging, it's more like spell check. And it's like, yeah, great. If you don't need it, then don't use it. But if you do need it, use it. But the autocomplete or the code generation side of it, it's like, this might get in your way. So I would prefer that you just try to write it yourself first.
Yeah, I'd be in a lot of trouble if I sent every email after just hitting tab of whatever Gmail thinks meant to add on to that sentence. Right. It definitely doesn't always catch it. Code tools the same way. So a lot of this too, I mean, gets to the challenge of managing these things across a team is that different team members are motivated by different things. I was always, as a developer, most motivated in my work when I could see the impact of it on customers directly and interact with them. Others are more intrinsically motivated by working with the latest cool tech. So I think my last question to you around developer experience is because, you know, it could mean so many different things to different developers of what makes a positive experience for them. What is kind of the best way as a manager to maintain morale across a team where individual members are motivated by different things?
Well, I don't think this is unique to engineering teams.
Sure.
You know, people are motivated by many different things in all different types of fields and jobs. I would say that on an engineering team though, value is the key word there. So when you're talking about, you know, I'm motivated by providing value to a user or a client versus like I'm motivated by playing with the newest, coolest thing. Like the newest, coolest thing is also a value. Like you're learning the latest technology and you're providing value by being a subject matter expert on that latest technology. So it's really recognizing where people are seeing the value in the work that they're doing and making sure that's aligned with like the business goals. If, you know, there's sometimes you have people that like what they value is not what the business values or the company values. And, you know, maybe they are not right for that company or, you know, maybe it's something where you just, you try and find other things that they value, you know, maybe a little bit less, but that you could focus on. So I like to, you know, in my one-on-ones, dive into the work that people are doing and sort of get a feeling for what they are talking about positively in that work. You know, I have engineers that talk about the number of PRs that they were able to put in or even get merged. I have PR, you know, engineers that talk about the number of tests that they wrote. Like, oh, I backfilled a whole bunch of tests. And so no, this whole part of the application is filled with tests, is covered by tests. And those are, you know, different values, like productivity, speed, efficiency, safety, security, releasing stable code. They're all great, but you have to understand like where your team individually is focusing, and then not trying to like play up one over the other, I suppose. It's kind of it can be demoralizing if your team member is like, yeah, I just spent 3 days backfilling a bunch of tests and now our code is super stable and I shipped it and it's great. And then the next week, everyone applauds the like person that ran for fast and broke something in like shipping a new feature that was like ahead of schedule and, but didn't have any tests covered or something. You know, you have to be mindful of like how you're congratulating and celebrating the work that's being done. I think that's,
celebrating reduction of technical debt, just, you know, in this, as well as celebrating technical innovation. They're both important. Different members of your team value those differently and want, you know, the celebration of that thing that they did. And, you know, maybe that's sort of the theme of our whole conversation today is that, you know, different people are motivated by different things. We all come from different backgrounds, and this is the value and the challenge for us as engineering managers that we need to be intentional about having an inclusive environment, having a diverse environment of lots of different perspectives and backgrounds. And then our job as a manager is to make sure that we're creating a positive developer experience for them in the realm of software development, but a strong team culture that values all of those different backgrounds and brings together their different skills and celebrates the different things that they bring to the team. So let's, Ben, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much. How can our listeners get in touch with you and how can they learn more about Planet Argon's work?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you. Likewise. I had a really good time chatting with you. You can find me on LinkedIn. Ben Pariseau is my name, and that is what I'm under. So just go search that. You can find Planet Argon at planetargon.com. And you can also find us on Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram, I believe, too. A very robust Instagram. So if you want to see pics of our culture club meetings, weird screenshots from Zoom events, check us out there too.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ben. Really appreciate you joining me on the Scaling Tech Podcast today.
Thank you.
On behalf of the thousands of developers we've placed with our clients, I want to briefly tell you about our sponsor, Agility Feed. Agility Feed has been building nearshore agile teams for U.S. companies since 2010. We were an early pioneer in doing this sort of developer staffing. Our team can help you recruit talented software engineers and technical teams in Latin America. We'll handle all aspects of recruiting, contracting, and payments for you so you can focus on delivering great software. To learn more, check us out at agilityfeat.com. That's agilityfeat.com.